took a special company to convince me to do an ad for clothing, and that company is Quince. Imagine buying fewer, better pieces you love to wear all the time instead of an infinite scroll of crap. The best piece I got so far is a navy blue button-down shirt, the organic cotton stretch textured twill shirt, and it replaces like six others that got stolen from the laundromat last month. Feels different, fits different, and washes great. No crunchy crease in the elbows or itchy seams at the wrist, just soft structure, refined, casual details, no strings dangling. You'll see it in my next monologue. So buy less, buy better, look great. Win jobs, meet lovers, organically, ethically, and at reasonable prices with Quince. Have a closet of keepers, not landfill. Upgrade your everyday. Download the Quince app for app-exclusive offers or go to quince.com/teamhuman. Get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada and the UK too. That's quince.com/teamhuman.
Over 90 of the top 100 U.S. accounting firms trust Bill to simplify and secure bill pay. That's proven financial infrastructure built on over $1 trillion of secure payments. Visit bill.com/proven for a special offer.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Michael Gargiulo stalked and slaughtered his female neighbors in L.A. in the 2000s, until one survived.
She painted a picture that you could never imagine.
In a first on Mind of a Monster, we dive into a case that's still active. Did Michael's murderous rampage start in the 1990s, when he was just 17?
His impulsivity and his rage was starting to peak around that age.
Listen to Mind of a Monster, The Hollywood Ripper, wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a special episode of Team Human, recorded live in New York City on December 10th, 2024. Hope you like it. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, coming to you alive from CX Collective in Soho, New York, a cooperative social club for playful people. If Burning Man and Studio 54 had a baby, it would be CX. Playing for Team Human today, occult historian, host of Alien Encounters, the author of Modern Occultism, and my own personal mage, Mitch Horowitz. I'm going to be engaging with Mitch about how collective occultism can arm us in the fight over reality. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Well, hey, everybody. So we did an event here at CX on election night as preparation for when the election returns would be coming in. And we styled it like a Quaker meeting where people who felt inspired in the moment got up one at a time and shared how they were feeling, their hopes and fears, whatever they thought might assist the group in their personal spiritual journeys. And the rest of us just sat there and breathed, collectively metabolizing whatever was being shared, staying in silence for a while until the next person got up. And the effect was more profound than I would have imagined. When the returns actually came in, it wasn't nearly as traumatic or shocking as I expected. If anything, it felt more like those images and numbers on the screens were just figures. Pictures and ideas up there on the TV that had little to do with what was going on here in the real world of connection and feeling. And it's not that it didn't matter. It's that it wasn't matter at all. I never had a more profound sense of clarity about the difference between the image and reality, the figures on the screen and life on the ground. And in the days and now weeks since the election, I've gotten really thousands of emails and messages, all in one way or another, asking, what do we do now? And by what do we do, they didn't mean actually do for each other here in the lived reality, but what do we need to do about the presidency, the Democratic Party? How do we strategize for 2028? What did Kamala and the Democrats do wrong? As if our primary focus as a people should be on political machination, presidential politics, or more to the point, changing the figure on the TV. Making the picture up there change, like the movie being there, that we should just change the channel. And I don't mean to suggest that presidential politics is completely unimportant, but how many of us really need to dedicate ourselves primarily to analyzing and strategizing that process? Is that really where our collective energy is best expended? Does the volume of people trying to figure that out really matter? What if we turned to one another more simply instead? What if we worked collectively on the challenges we're facing on the ground? When I suggested such a thing in that last monologue on the show, I got a lot of negative reaction. I mean, all over. It was like, you're putting your head in the sand. You're doing magical thinking. You like that one, Mitch? Magical thinking, right? You're in denial. Don't retreat. So, okay. What if we tasked 1% of the population with strategizing the next presidential campaign plus the midterms? There's approximately, I looked this up, 260 million adults in America right now. So how about we put 1%, 2.6 million of them, 1% on the job of strategizing what went wrong for progressives in the last election? Is that enough? 2.6 million? I think they'll have a hard enough time getting all those voices heard, right? 2.6 million is definitely more than enough. And then that will free up the other 257 million adults to take care of each other by engaging in mutual aid, community activity, educating each other and our young, caring for the sick, building local economic and environmental resiliency. While the 2.6 million can focus on electing an administration that can make FEMA more effective rather than seeing it as a deep state conspiracy, the rest of us can work toward communities that can take care of the most vulnerable when the next weather disaster strikes. Because I'll be honest here, FEMA's not coming. Or if they are, we're going to need to be able to hold out for more than weeks or months than we might expect. At the very least, by taking care of each other here on the ground, we can reduce the stress that we're putting on the centralized government institutions that are currently crumbling under their own weight. If the FDA or the Department of Education are going to be crippled by intentionally any government policies, let's take some of their essential functions on ourselves as best we can by growing good food, teaching kids in after-school programs and literacy workshops, taking care of older people. This is not rocket science. Government programs may need to be treated like a last resort for the times when our bottom-up social networks fail. Right, 2.5 million strategist advisors is enough. And besides, most of the time, honestly, folks like us are rarely listened to anyway. Artists, counterculturalists, magicians, ecstatic dancers, mushroom ceremonialists. We are the weird ones, the people whose utility value can't quite be measured in government-friendly metrics. I know a lot of us are upset about this seeming trend toward authoritarianism or oligarchy, or as I see it, techno-feudalism. But if you look at the history of Western civilization, this is actually the norm. Post-war American democracy and Eurozone cooperation, they're the aberration. Now, in the sped-up digital media environment, we're reverting to the mean. That's what AI does, after all. It produces the average response, the most likely answer given the entire history of answers out there. It's the opposite of creativity or improvement. It is literally reversion to the mean. And so here we are, going back to feudalism, which is the basis of our civilization. We've been an essentially colonial civilization since the first enclosed farm, since agriculture, really, but definitely since territorial wars, slavery, and resource extraction. It's what we do. not just with imperial armies, but with basic capitalism. This is our average, our normal. A digital media environment with algorithms and AIs iterating all that is into what will be, creating predictability on behalf of the investors and billionaires programming this landscape, it's going to revert to the mean. It's basic karma. We run out of places to colonize, so we colonize ourselves. Now, people like me thought digital technology and the internet stood a chance of changing some of this. If not changing society wholesale, at least creating pockets of weirdness where other possibilities could be entertained. There was a barrier to entry. Learning to use a computer meant learning to program a computer, kind of like learning to read means learning how to write. So only those with a sense of purpose took the effort to actually learn how to use a modem and type in a subnet mask. That kind of person could get on the internet. Back then, though, every Usenet group and IRC channel was its own pocket of weirdness, of exceptions to the rule and diversion from the mean. This group debated the homoeroticism of Star Trek, while this one compared strategies for cultural subversion through sigil magic. The discussions were specific, non-generic, non-mainstream. And it was the era of grunge music, and it satisfied that grunge Gen X need to play in areas and with modes undigestible by the mainstream. As the internet became an always-on mainstream phenomenon, though, it too reverted to the mean. Influencer culture happens at scale. It's not about finding the bizarre nooks and crannies of the weird, but reaching as many people as possible. Hit counts and numbers of followers. It's about getting bigger rather than smaller, reaching toward figures and away from the ground. And as a result, it has to tend toward spectacle, to the giganticism of Twitter, which is not a kind of place that welcomes the noobs. The only thing we seem to have in common at scale are cruelty and nationalism, polarization and difference writ large. That's why the big issue of the past election, it was immigration. The facts on the ground, a decrease in actual immigration, don't matter. It's back to the big artificial lines that digital quantized measurements can understand. Yes, no, black, white, American, other. If the distinctions don't hold, build a wall. That's our civilization. Subject, object, colonizer, colonizer. Now it's being amplified by these digital feedback systems. It has zero tolerance for the ambivalent, for the ambiguous. It's about boundaries, even though those boundaries don't really work or exist in the real world. And the artificial boundaries, they are intrinsically violent constructions. You're a baby born on this side of the line, you're entitled to social services. You're born on that side of the line, you're not. What, think Haiti and Dominican Republic. They're on the same fucking island, but which side of the imaginary line you're born on determines what sort of life and opportunities you're going to have. The ones and zeros of the digital map tolerate no error or noise. It's an auto-tuned reality where everything is on the note or it doesn't exist. Never mind that James Brown reaching up to that note is where we find the soul of the music. In the world of digital figures, that expression of the human soul is noise. In the landscapes of one and zeros, there is no weirdness, no in-between. But that liminal zone, that's the wiggle room. That's the give on which a culture or even life depend. It's the interstitial space where magic happens. It's the subtle, familiar, and decidedly not the mean. And in order to make room for this weird, this liminal zone of possibility, we need to get off the grid-like map of quantized utility and grow a culture instead. We do this together by forming clusters of human weirdness, groups of people with varying forms of space, voltage, and potential between them. We need a cohort, a rabble, what Jews called a chavara, or what witches call a coven, the collective aspiration of CX, where we're gathered tonight. Well, what are the precursors to such shared moments in culture? How do we create the set and setting for a cluster of weirdness here at the CX or anywhere Team Human is gathering? What allows for such a layer to form? How do we create the conditions for a tide pool in a world where only rivers seem to flow? To help us answer this question, I've invited my friend, mentor, and oft-times role model, Mitch Horowitz, to join us tonight. One of today's most acclaimed voices of esoterica, mysticism, and the unexplained, Mitch Horowitz hosts Discovery HBO's Alien Encounters, Fact or Fiction, SpectreVision's new podcast, Extraordinary Evidence, ESP is Real, and plays himself in Shudder's VHS Beyond. A Penn Award-winning historian with bylines in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Mitch has appeared on CBS, Sunday Morning, Dateline NBC, NPR's All Things Considered, and throughout national media. A former vice president at Penguin Random House, he was rescued. Mitch is the author of books including Occult America, The Miracle Club, Daydream Believer, Modern Occultism, and the forthcoming Practical Magic. His work is censored in China, but available at this table after the recording. Please welcome Mitch Horowitz. So that was a mouthful. But you were coming, so I wanted to kind of lay it out. In some ways I'm asking for a consult on the sort of what are great historical examples when a cluster of weird has emerged, and what are the precursors to clusters of weirdness so that we can maybe take some lessons from these historical examples and then bring them into this space as well as wherever people are listening and hoping for a cluster to form.
Well, it's first of all, thank you so much. And thanks to the organizers for this space and to you for your continued work and efforts. It's very important. It seems to me that when clusters of ideas form and when ideas become very potent and very powerful, and sometimes when we as individuals read stuff from history, it's usually under conditions of terrible pressure. After the Roman Empire decided it had enough of the Jewish people and kicked them out of the Mediterranean, that's when the Talmud was born. That's when Kabbalah was born. That's when the Torah kind of moving arc was born. When there was a backlash against occult experimentation during the Renaissance, from that Freemasonry was born, which became a kind of clandestine grouping of people who held keep over the flame of occult and esoteric experimentation. In many regards, some of the things that have reached us today, and they're just really fragments from late antiquity, from a period of time when there were polytheistic religions in Persia, Rome, North Africa, the Hellenic world, and so forth. I mean, those fragments reached us because people kept them, vouchsafed them during times of terrible, terrible pressure. And Masonry was among the institutions that I think maintained esoteric practice, symbol, used occult symbolism as a code for ethical development at a time when the 30 Years' War was about to break out in Central Europe in 1618, and occult experimentation was over as an above-ground reality. So it fell to individuals, usually in very small little groupings. Little platoons, as Oliver Burke called it. And that's how knowledge and understanding survived. And so when we read material from that era, or material from that era is available to the modern person, it's usually in times of real darkness where seeking people had to almost carry ideas like you would carry a candle in a rainstorm.
So the darkness is good.
The darkness is good. Yes. I mean, I don't want anybody to experience pain. The last thing on earth I want is for myself or for people I love or for strangers to experience pain. I certainly don't want that to happen. And if the alleviation from pain meant giving up certain opportunities, I would probably fall on the side of the alleviation of pain. But we don't have those choices. And there does seem to be this yin and yang, this as above, so below, this reciprocal action, that in periods of contraction, there's also collections of very concentrated wisdom.
Right. I mean, and I know those ones either from you know, what it was like to be in college during the Reagan years and suddenly everything gets strange and punky and psychedelic, or to think back to, you know, medieval Jews who, you know, unable to practice Judaism, were hiding up in their attics and developing mysticism and Kabbalah.
Right.
So it flips that way. But then there's also, and maybe these are just imagined from watching, you know, Woody Allen's After Midnight, whatever that one, that one where it keep going back to artistic periods of the past, you know, that I imagine, oh, if only I were in 6th century Egypt, you know, with people drinking coffee and studying Talmud and reading weird shit and listening to, you know, we could have a discussion about Aristotle and the Babylonian Talmud in the same coffee shop with Maimonides and I mean, there are these moments that happen.
It's interesting. Not only are there these moments that happen, but we don't get to necessarily choose who the participants are. And I think that's so especially important for our culture, which is a culture that is so based, and this includes myself. I presume it includes everybody in this room, unless there are any bodhisattvas here. There's a competition. There's a wish to win. And we can't always choose who our partners are on the path. Like you were referencing, I thought very rightly, the extent to which quantity is such a kind of false god in our culture today. I think the 20th century figure who had the greatest analysis of that was a traditionalist philosopher named René Guénon, who wrote a book called The Reign of Quantity about the very problem you were putting your finger on. And yet Guénon, who relocated from Paris to Cairo for the very reasons that you're describing, he was also very anti-liberal, very anti-individualist. He despised the 20th century. And if you read him and you had a conversation with him, you guys would have a magical conversation around quantity and the problem of quantity as a modernist value. But you might have terrible disagreements about other things, you know, politically.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's plenty of folks, like you put me in a room with, you know, Jordan Peterson or Curtis Yarvin or somebody.
Right.
You know, on the right circumstances, it might be fun, you know, if it didn't matter.
You know, it's this grotesque need, I think, that the thing that gets in the way of those exchanges, there are times for competition. There are times for competition. You want to win an election. You want to win in athletics. You don't go to the Olympics because you want to lose or you don't care. I mean, please, that's a fantasy. Right. There are times for competition. But we as a culture have excelled at bringing competition into ideas and discussion. And I'm part of it. You know, we all think about the famous Thanksgiving argument with Uncle Mike, who we can't stand. But, you know, I'm Uncle Mike to some people and they can't stand me. And I'm trying to competition in its place, you know, in its place. If you practice combat sports, yes, to competition. But we can't have that around ideas and expect to get anywhere.
Right. So instead you
play in elections.
Right. But you can, in conversation, you can play a yes and, I guess.
How so?
Well, instead of,
I see what you're
saying.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I got you.
Indeed.
I mean, you know, it's funny. You were saying that you came under tremendous criticism from people who accused you of magical thinking
right.
in the face of the election. I disdain that phrase only because the people who employ it as a weapon never apply it to themselves. Always
right.
as though cognitive bias is somebody else's problem, and it's never my problem. And it seems to me that an issue, you know, as we ask ourselves, gee, what went wrong? You know, what went wrong? I think modernist culture, modernist letters, is very, very divorced from the spiritual or the extraphysical. And I've often asked myself about that because it's weird insofar as a lot of the architects of modernist philosophy, and to me, modernist philosophy is the search for antecedents. You know, we witness a circumstance in life, whatever it may be, and we assume there's something behind this. Well, what is it? You know, I mean, Darwin wasn't atheistic. Freud actually was not atheistic. William James was not atheistic. Isaac Newton was not atheistic. Albert Einstein was not atheistic. Why is there such a division between modernism and the extraphysical, between believing that we're bound by something other than economics or flesh and bone? I mean, this, forgive me if this sounds like brutal shorthand. I'm just working on this idea, so you're hearing it with training wheels. But I think it came down to Marx in 1873 saying that Hegel had it right in terms of the conflagration of ideas, ideas bumping up against one another, shaping our world. But Hegel had it wrong because he believed in ideas as actual things,
right,
and Marx believed in economics. I think that was a tragedy.
Right. No, and it was an interesting moment because if you're going to be a good Marxist or teach at the university, it's always conditions on the ground, conditions on the ground, conditions on the ground. And conditions on the ground are real because that's where a lot of pain and suffering happens. But first off, you can have pain and suffering not in your condition on the ground. You can have pain and suffering on a cosmic level that's not on the ground and immeasurable. But we'll leave that aside. But what happened was, if Marxism and social justice meant focusing on conditions on the ground, then the focusing on something else, like the metaphor of the tree in the forest, that's fascist. Right, and we kind
exactly.
of ceded metaphor to the fascists and claimed conditions on the ground for ourselves, and we lost the enchantment of life.
Yes, we started dressing like them, but we ceded the idea, you know, to them, and I think that was tragic. And I think that I'm very concerned about the way in which people who see themselves as progressive are often first in line to use weaponized terms like magical thinking, or, for example, who piss on philosophies like positive mind metaphysics or new thought. And the only thing they can tell you about Norman Vincent Peale is that, you know, Trump read Norman Vincent yeah. Peale. They can't tell you that Norman Vincent Peale, for example, also destigmatized visiting a therapist, for example, in the 1930s.
Right.
And the notion that people who don't know better attend prosperity ministries or turn to mysticism or turn to religion, I think is deeply tragic because it suggests that those people, in fact, if they were in the know, would do differently. And it suggests, and I think people pick up on this, they really
right.
do, that they're just not smart enough to know what's good for them. And people hate that. They resent it.
And even if Trump was, and he was, a student of Norman Vincent Peale, hearing power of positive thinking, and we can make reality and all that, and we don't like Trump and all that. Yes, 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 yes. And the moment that he got semi-shot, the fluidity and the instant intuitive metabolism of that event and converting it into fight, fight, fight. Who in this room would be able? I would just be, oh my God, they're shooting at me. My ear hurts. Right? Or how dare they? Or something. But to have the not, it's not presence of mind at that point. It's presence of something was so well trained, so well ingrained in who he is and what he does that for all his problems, there wasn't some good lessons he got in there.
It was like this mass emotion, you know, just took over. And I mean, it was peculiar. You know, I saw Tucker Carlson at the Republican convention saying that he thought it was, what was it, like an act of God or an act
right.
of providence. And I disdain that because how the hell would I know, you know, that it's, and I don't even think like Tucker thinks. I used to know him in my 20s, uh-huh. actually. And he was exactly the same then as he is today.
He was a little bit more, I knew him back when too. He was more like
chill.
like the Michael J. Fox character in Family
right.
Ties.
Right.
It was sort of more like that.
Yeah. But the adopting of this language of a kind of manifest providence is also dangerous as hell because it's so presumptive and it's so triumphalist, but it does obviously feed the emotions.
Right. And I mean, to some extent, whatever works, works.
Yeah.
Right?
And I also don't, of course, you know, we all in the West are hemmed into this Abrahamic way of viewing God. You know, the Jewish God, the Christian God, the Muslim God. It's very similar, and it's extraordinary that everybody is so incapable of functioning together because the religious model is pretty much like you do the right thing and the man upstairs will water your fields in the right season and things will go well for you. And I think there's a particle of something true there. I mean, we talk about it as reciprocity sometimes, but that notion is so baked into our outlook and it's not that old. You know, it's not that old. We had a fissure in the West where we wiped away after the Emperor Constantine converted to a version of Christianity in the early 300s, the polytheistic religious traditions everywhere that Alexander the Great had set down his sandals from Persia to North Africa to the Middle East to Western part of Eastern Europe and its offshoots. over centuries, the polytheistic traditions were wiped out, and a monotheistic tradition, chiefly Christianity, and then later Islam, took hold. And we have this weird amnesia where we think in these absolutes of reality, and it just wasn't that long ago that we were a polytheistic people.
And were the, when they wiped it out, I guess, were they, I'm so fixated on this maintenance of pockets of weird. And it feels like at the end of polytheism, there were pockets of weird.
Oh, without question.
You know, and then it's like, oh, there's one, and then they stamp it out or mainstreamize it. But it, this tension between, that's why I was sort of thinking of it in terms of rivers and tide pools or mainstream and weirdness or figure and ground that in, right now in our time, it feels so difficult to maintain a pocket of weird. We can have a temporary autonomous zone of even 90 minutes tonight, and that's like a fucking miracle, and I'll be weeping tonight,
right,
just that this has happened. But that's, on the one measure, yes, beautiful, how much I appreciate us being together, but on the other hand, how horrific it is that this is so rare.
It is rare, and it's funny, as you were talking about these pockets of weird, I thought to myself that, like, in terms of the Western world, nowadays, there's kind of this, it's difficult to talk about this. There's this kind of middle brow point of view that, like, at least from the 19th and 20th century, that, like, the German nation or the German speaking people are this warlike people. They fucked us in World War I. They fucked us in World War II. The Franco-Prussian Wars, just another example. But, like, actually, the modern nation of Germany was the last holdout in terms of polytheism. It wasn't until the 700s that Christianity really caught up with Germany. And then the area of Central Europe that's German-speaking was a really super experimental area during the Renaissance. Alchemy, astrology, divination, number symbolism, you name it. You know, it was running riot through Central Europe. 30 Years' War breaks out in 1618, pretty much pits Catholic versus Protestant armies, the Protestant armies representing more of an ideal of religious freedom, Catholic armies retrenchment. That area just gets wiped out. And so we think of Germany as having a legacy of war making in the 19th and 20th centuries, but that they were both in late antiquity and in the Renaissance, the last redoubt of this kind of culture of weird that you were talking about. We're trained to think otherwise, and things change over centuries, but it's a little scary.
Do you mean like the barbarians against the Romans, sort of that stuff?
To some extent, that was the barbarians against the Romans, but...
Because these were these people, I don't know if you saw the Netflix shows. I mean, it's weird, barbarian shows, Viking shows, and all that. They're I don't feel bad about these shows and watching them,
right,
not as historical, but as more accurate. Because the way the Viking gods or barbarian gods came down to us through popular culture and Marvel comics all the way to Netflix means that they've been honed even more to their essential mythic, right, truth.
It's Thor and Loki, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's Thor and Loki. And the German-speaking regions of Europe, they were really holdouts for a long time, holding on to polytheism. And then again, a polytheistic revival, kind of, during the Reformation and the occult Renaissance. And they just got wiped out. And and then, I mean, there's so much that one could extrapolate from that. But what is Bohemia in the most literal sense? One generation, several generations later, can be something radically different.
But that's... Tradition is closer now to what we think of as the right than the left. I mean, it's the QAnon guys with the Tor helmets and the stuff.
Yeah.
That guy and the but there's a well, it's interesting. Or you look at the tattoos all over that guy that they're nominating for something or other, who they say drinks. He's got all these weird.
Oh, which guy is the?
Who's the guy? Yeah.
What's it?
Hexel. Oh. Yeah, that he's got. But I think those are more Christian.
Iconography.
Over 90 of the top 100 U.S. accounting firms trust Bill to simplify and secure bill pay. That's proven financial infrastructure built on over $1 trillion of secure payments. Visit bill.com/proven for a special offer.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What if you laughed all through your commute? Or if you heard the funniest story while at the gym? Well, now you can. I'm Jameela Jamil, and guests on my new podcast, Wrong Turns, share their most mortifying and hilarious disaster stories. I'm talking people like Mae Martin, Bob the Drag Queen, Catherine Ryan, Jake Johnson, Margaret Cho, Simon Pegg, Penn Badgley, and so many more. So listen wherever you get your podcast, Wrong Turns, where dignity goes to die.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Tattoos. But there is this, when I was watching Viking and Barbarian shows during COVID, I was thinking, this is the logic of the Trump people. Of like yeah. returning, and I understood fascism in a different way, and of I empathized yeah. with fascism and the idea that everything's so universal. I mean, the way I complain about the internet is the way they complain about Jews, right? Jews are cosmopolitan, the universal. There is this all this sort of universal enlightenment, and everything is one. No, it's not. It's specific. We're local. This is our forest. This is where we're from. Mm-hmm. So we spilled our blood on this land. And I kind of get, oh, I get it. You've got these sort of local gods and weirdness, just like right. we respect it in Native Americans and their indigenous land right over there in Santa Fe, and we acknowledge here we are in the Lenape. Or the ground here, but it's like we won't give it to them, right?
Right. It's funny. The right wing and religion present a puzzle, you know, especially for those of us who are interested in the extraphysical. I remember when my first book, Occult America, came out in 2009, I received a phone call from a man who was not yet famous, Steve Bannon, who I think is getting out of prison any day now. And he said to me, you know, you probably don't know who I am. I'm a conservative documentarian. I'm a financier. And I said, you know, why are you down with my stuff? And he told me that his daughter was going to school at Colgate University in Central New York State. I read a lot about Central New York, especially in that book, as a kind of springboard for religious experimentalism, as unlikely as one would think yeah. of the German-speaking part of Central Europe. But there it was. And he said, I finally get it. You know, I keep driving through there, and it seems like such a weird place. Like, what's up with this place? And I spend the first third of Occult America talking about all the avant-garde movements that came out of Central New York.
Where and you can go do mushroom ceremony today.
That's right. I mean, you could drive up there tonight with Doug and, you know, go on somebody's farm. And, you know, the truth is, we never talked about politics, rarely, and we were friends. And then when the whole election denialism thing started, I backed off because I just couldn't deal with that. And yet, he was so well-read in the people that we have been indirectly talking about. He was well-read in Jung, for example. He was well-read in, just all kinds of places. You know, I have a book called Daydream Believer where there's a political figure in the book I don't identify, but I think I'll identify him tonight. This will be a first. It's Steve. You know, he was staying at that fancy hotel up on Park Avenue where all the big shakers stay, the Hyatt Regency yeah. or something. Anyway, he was there, and I, you know, years ago, I was living on the Lower East Side, and he asked me to come over. So I biked up there. I came over, plopped myself down with my bike helmet, and he said, who's the best person? Who's the smartest figure, the most intellectually persuasive figure in New Thought? And I said, Neville Goddard, big influence on me. And he said, no, I didn't ask you who's the coolest. I asked you who's the smartest. And I said, it's Neville. And we talked about it, but we were able to have conversations with that. And then our politics went like that. But it makes an impression on you.
Right. I mean, because they have been successful in creating some pretty big pockets of weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so much so that was the main critique that the Dems would say, oh, but they're just so weird. They're weird. And I'm like, oh, but weird is a good word to me, not a bad word.
Yeah. I mean, actually, speaking of pockets of weird, my partner and I, Jacqueline, several weeks ago attended a convention that I'm sure you know, you've probably been invited, called Hereticon, which is run by the billionaire Peter Thiel. And it happens every couple of years. I gave a couple of talks there. You know, you meet people, you talk, you get together. It was, listen, I have to be frank with you. It was a very easy atmosphere for me to function in. You know, we talked about ideas not very different from the stuff we're talking about now. The first Hereticon, a lot of people came up to me and said, you're into Neville. I want to talk to you about this guy. You're into Crowley. I want to talk to you about this guy. And there was an openness to talk about this stuff, even though the crowd was ostensibly tech.
Well, tech is the nice word for it. I mean, you know.
Feudal lords is the word I think you've used.
Yeah, and these are quantized fascists. But no, I mean, I was invited to one of the first ones, and it was like right smack in the middle of COVID. And I was like, the last thing I want to do is go hang out in a hotel with a bunch of COVID deniers and no masks. And
well, you'll come to the next one.
Yeah, but, yeah, well, I couldn't get, I think then after the Survival of the Richest book, I haven't been able to get him on the email again.
So I'll
use you. I'll CC you.
Harriet,
I want to get in. No, because it sounds like it's almost like an intellectual fight club. And the fun thing about it is if it is a fight club, they welcome you. It's like, oh, you're a fucking Marxist psychedelic person. Okay, let's have it out.
Yes.
But that, in some ways, if it wasn't for the political repercussions of some of what they do, that would be fun.
Oh, without question. You know, I mean, you also find that there is a passion for ideas. You know, those 3 days that you're in that place, there's a passion for ideas. And it's very helpful. And you get challenged. And you get asked questions that are tough questions.
And you think about how weird the ideas of the people that we now revere, how weird their ideas were at the time. I mean, I hung out with, you know, a lot with Timothy Leary, you know, Robert Anton Wilson, William Burroughs. These folks, but, you know, there was some really dark shit that people were thinking about politics, about economics. It was a huge, a really strong, staunch libertarian stream.
Yes.
You know,
and I put a question to you in that respect. Have people who are traditionally affiliated with what we call the progressive culture, and I think all this stuff is in realignment right now, so I feel like it's like I'm using this term on the Titanic, but for people who are part of that culture, has there been a withering of the ability or the wish to experiment, you know, really experiment? Because that was present in all everybody you've just described.
Right.
Sometimes dangerous.
I mean, there seems to be a lot of willingness to experiment personally, you know, and that's partly because the downside of making pot legal through medical marijuana is it became so much about the individual body. And now we're kind of doing the same thing with psychedelics. And it's like, oh, it's about my, you know, and it's fine. It's good, you know, and I've done, you know, personal healing and getting over my trauma and even doing it in group, but everybody's getting over their individual trauma with using the collective whatever of the group. But it's like, when do psychedelics, when do these insights, when is our magic, when is our culture fucking with reality?
Right. And you know, here's a perfect case in point. I'm sure many of you in this room know who John Mack was. He was a Harvard psychiatrist who grew interested in alien abduction phenomena. And John spent years and years and years interviewing and counseling people who reported abduction experiences. And he came to this radical and very intellectually integral conclusion. He said, look, I'm a trauma specialist. Based on my training and based on what I've been taught to do and to teach students, apropos of when is a trauma real, when is it imaginary, whatever, these people are telling the truth. Now, if you don't like my answer, you can go to another trauma specialist. Be my guest. But applying the tools of the trade, these experiencers of alien abduction are telling the truth. You all can have whatever discussion you want about metaphysics and extraterrestrial travel and whatever. Yeah. I'm speaking from my field. And he almost lost his job.
And there's the one right before him. It's so funny when you say that. It's the same story. In middle school, there was this guy, Moody.
Yeah, Ray Moody.
Ray Moody. Around. And he was doing, it was called Life After Life. And he was a real, like, doctor dude, like a real rigorous guy. And, like, everyone he went to had the same experience of going to the things as originally seeing the light right before Poltergeist came out. You know, everybody's.
Yeah.
And he got so shit on, basically, like Marianne Williamson times X, you know, just like, oh, you're. And she doesn't deserve it either. You know, right. Just like, you know, you're a limp just off the map.
Right. Yeah. Ray, as you were saying, Ray, who's still with us, Ray Moody is a physician who wrote a book in 1975 called Life After Life. He coined the term near-death experience. And a great deal like John Mack, you know, he said, look, I am talking to hundreds and actually, at a certain point, thousands of people. And I see absolutely nothing here that suggests psychosis or delusion or, you know, any of the terms that we use to brutally or magical thinking to wipe away the experience. And he was pilloried for it. And I think we've really lost something. Yeah. You know, I mean, John Mack died very young. He was hit by a drunk driver in London, and he died very young. But he had to, tooth and nail, he was going to get fired from Harvard. I mean, he was going to lose his job. And that is a nightmare scenario to me.
Well, same as Leary before him.
Yeah, same as Leary.
Same deal.
Ooh, I mean, they could say to him, look, just come in on Tuesdays, for God's sake, you know. Yeah. But the notion that you have to expel someone from the temple is the most intellectually chilling thing I can imagine.
Right. And then the only people then from it, feels like anyway, from the overculture who were allowed to maintain a connection to these liminal sensibilities, let's call them, were the marketers.
Yes, right.
You know,
right.
Because it works, right? It's because it works, because people will believe in Mr. Clean or whatever they came up with, you know?
Right. It was funny. Shortly before his death, John Mack was being interviewed by the Terence McKenna, the great consciousness explorer, and they had a very short conversation. You can find it on YouTube. Just put in John Mack, Terence McKenna. It's 15 minutes, but it's so good because, you know, John had to go to some workshop or something, and McKenna said to him, did you want to add anything else? And John said, yes. It seems to me that within Western culture, we can talk about religion and we can couch it in terms of mythology. We can couch it in terms of fiction. We can couch it in terms of, you know, certain, maybe there's a transpersonal psychology here and there that we're willing to abide. But the notion that the extraphysical can have any concrete effect on actuality in our world, even to the point of just turning a little dial on a chart, or even in terms of allowing you to guess a greater than statistical hit rate on a deck of cards, the notion that any kind of extraphysical influence can be measurable in our world in a way that goes beyond the subjective, that will get you pushed out of the temple.
Right. Because the whole thing is that, well, the temple is the temple sort of a Francis Bacon and evidence-based reality,
yeah.
Right? But it's the funny thing is then it is not open to evidence that evidence shifts. It's what got Rupert Sheldrake kicked out, because he did a TED talk where he suggested, he said, what if, you know, we have evolution for biology and all that. What if the rules of physics evolve over time? What if the rules actually change? And they were like, you're not allowed. It's like, you're not allowed to say that or do that. It's like, once you get the rule, you got to lock that down. It's like, you could be wrong about the rule, but the rule can't fucking change. Because it's like, realities, then reality shimmying, right?
Yeah. Yes. And another thing that's interesting about Rupert Sheldrake, the man was a Cambridge-educated biologist, has all the academic awards that you would ever hope for. He asked himself a simple question at a certain point in his career. We all colloquially use the term animal instinct. We all have used that term at one time or another. We all know what it means. Well, what the hell is it? And so he began to research this, and it took him into directions of parapsychology. And he did an extraordinary and profoundly rigorous study on basically dogs who are aware of when their owners are coming home, starting out, embarking from work or whatever errand somebody is on. And he mapped this out using the rules of the road, and he was subjected to the most humiliating calumny for it, and it makes a great laugh line, ha ha, you know, Rupert thinks dogs have ESP. And we study what we call animal instinct all the time. How do carrier pigeons know the hell where they're going? You know, how do animals learn things? This is a field of zoology. Yeah. But we can't talk about the prospect that there is some extraphysical, he called it morphic fields, form of communication, no matter how conservatively that research is pursued.
Right. I mean, and there are all these places in science that these terms like animal instinct or another one's emergence, mm-hmm. that are basically these big hand waves. Just, oh, well, that's, how did that happen? That's emergence. Like, why did those ants start behaving like a colony or the colony? emergence. It's like, what is this? Exactly. That word gets to be a science word, but magic doesn't at that point. Right. And it's like, you don't understand why those things happen. You're just throwing a word on it, and your word is no less a religion than anyone else's.
Without question. And as everyone in this room, I think, would agree, we as a human community use the term science as religion today. Science is the tablets brought down from Mount Sinai. All science is methodological replication. And if you're following the rules of the road, and if the data is uncorrupted, if the data is unpolluted, the anti-intellectualism that rejects that data, that is an area of big focus for me right now. That's why I'm doing this podcast, Extraordinary Evidence. This stuff is as real as it gets. Or aspirin isn't real, or boiling water right. isn't real. It occurs, and it can be replicated.
Right, but the problem is it doesn't help them revert to the mean. It adds weirdness. It adds yeah. wiggle. It puts wobble in the steering wheel. You know, it's like because the project of, and I don't know which we want to call it, the project of control, the project of capitalism is repeatability. Mm-hmm. You know, so we can base, I mean, it's a sad life they want to create here, but where everything, we might as well be dead.
Well, this is the kind of criticism that I would contend with at Hereticon, which is why I found it a helpful atmosphere. The first time I was there, which was a couple of years ago, I gave a talk called Case Closed, ESP is Real. You can find it on YouTube. It's all of 30 minutes. And afterwards, a capitalist guy, tech guy, came up to me and he said, listen, I'm persuaded by your thesis. I believe that what you're talking about is real. But your problem is you have an engine that works 10% of the time. And for him, that disrupted monetization and so forth. And that's legit coming from him. And it was a legit criticism coming from the quantifiable values that rule the roost here in our culture. But it was helpful.
They have some weird that they're, I mean, in some ways, their side is less afraid of their weird.
Yeah.
Like the, a great proxy for weird was, and it was a bad proxy, but a great one, was the vaccine stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so their side was saying, we are repressing their experience and real experiences of real people and, even data, you know, the kids with myocarditis in Israel. And it's like, oh, we're going to fudge that data because we don't want people to be afraid. You know, it's like the last thing you want to do, especially if you're on the Marxist data side, is fuck with the data. At least be honest mm-hmm. with the data there, because otherwise you fuel even more, you know, fear and rage. But, you know, the vaccine was a great proxy for this same conflict between what the right wing would see as the leftist evidence-based deep state conspiracy and a more new age bottom up yeah. RFK magical holistic herbal witchy.
It's vexing because we always think, and I think, the revolution will look like me.
Right.
Everyone's going to see all the great ideas and insights that I possess, and there'll just be lots more of us. And that's a terrible blind spot in human nature. I think we have all believed for at least a couple of decades that a really big cultural and political realignment is coming. We all feel, it seems to me, the sense of dissatisfaction with words like right and left and progressive and libertarian, and we hang on to them because they are serviceable for the time being, but we feel how they're fraying, and that can be very disturbing because the realignment can look very different from what I say when I'm talking to myself, you know, shaving in the morning.
Right. So maybe those dudes are in our pockets of weird.
It could very well be. I mean, you've had conversations with people who most individuals would think, you know, you don't know, like Tucker Carlson. You guys, you may be in a show next week for all I know. I've described my experience with Steve Bannon. I do not have commensurate experiences with, say, skeptics, most of whom are left-leaning humanities or social science professors. And people sometimes say to me, why don't you debate them? I chase after them to debate. They dodge me and they hide because they're not as together as they appear to be. And, you know, the issues that I face when people deny data. It's not so much sort of saying, I like this, I don't like this, I like the implications, I don't like the implications. It's actual denial of data that have been arrived at following the rules of the road. The anti-intellectuals, they occupy those positions, which are powerful positions, and they run riot over Wikipedia. And I think they got about another 30 years, roughly a generation, of dominance.
In your travels, we'll cut off the history idea here, but in your travels, are you coming upon spaces? Are you coming upon pockets of weird as you go and you work, you know, you tour with the book? Do you go, oh, I was just in Memphis and it's a real pocket of weird there? I mean, are you finding cultures, communities that are sustaining the less temporary autonomous zones of collective strange?
I say this with some timidness because I don't like saying this, but the pockets of weird that I come across, oh, I don't know how this is going to sound because I've never said it out loud before, but they're usually more culturally conservative pockets of weird where I can have a 6-hour conversation with somebody about what Graham Hancock is attempting to do on Netflix and they're not shitting and pissing all over him. And to have that conversation is helpful to me. And those are mostly the places I find the pockets of weird.
And but there's more than one person.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. But I'm saying that when I find places where I can talk about what people might call alternative history,
right,
or very practical metaphysics, or ESP research, or retro causality, backwards causation, where shit that occurs in what we call the future affects stuff that happens in the past, which is so challenging to our paradigm, it's not infrequently among pockets of the world, whether it be in Mormon circles or whether it be in our tech overlord circles, where this stuff, it's not supposed to be happening there. And that's where I find that it's happening. And it can be, it can be disorienting.
Right. You go out to, want to meet UFO people, go out to 29 Palms.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they're not the people you would expect. They're not like us.
Right.
They're not cool.
And there are blind spots. You know, there are terrible blind spots, but you don't have this. There's a lot of experimentation within the hard sciences too. The places, and I don't mean to speak too generally, so forgive me, I'm really speaking in a blanket way, but the places that I find they're utter rejectionism for the kinds of things that you and I are describing usually are in the social sciences and the humanities. I don't find it among working people. I don't find it in the professions. I don't find it in the hard sciences.
Yeah, although the humanities went down a pretty...
pretty nasty.
Yeah, I mean, because in order to justify ourselves...
They took the wrong pill.
Yeah,
they got
exactly.
The red and the blue
exactly.
Mixed up.
They started to do digital humanities and try to make it look like a social science. Oh, this is not... we're not McLuhanite media theorists thinking weird thoughts. We're social scientists with data.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Like, for example... We've been belatedly watching this docuseries on HBO about the NXIVM cult. And there was a reporter at the New York Times, Barry Myers, I think, a very gifted reporter who sort of blew open the story about the NXIVM cult. And at one point, there's an interstitial interview with him. And he remarks, and it's so familiar to me, especially having struggled to write for some of those places over the years, he remarks, look, I'm not really against anybody availing themselves of self-help or self-improvement. I have no interest in it. I'll never get better. So I am unconcerned. I'm insulated from all that shit. And he uses that word, shit. And I was like, dude, that is so familiar to me. That is so familiar to me. There's an intrinsic disdain for... I don't know what to call it, frankly. This impulse towards self-evaluation that goes outside the physicalist, and there's a disdain for it, and it's very hard to crack open, and people sense it, and it makes them cynical about those institutions,
right? Because they're not acknowledging what seems to be so plain, mm-hmm. And that's the other thing is that so far anyway. That's what I was trying to say in the monologue. Digital stuff, the internet and computers originally seemed to be places to celebrate that.
Right.
The first computer program I wrote, was a commercial program, was for Cyber Tarot. It's tarot cards, the I Ching, you know, Time Wave Zero. Oh. It was the weirdest shit. We were going to iterate out fractal, psychedelic reality. Even Kraftwerk, for God's sake. It's just like, listen to this sawtooth wave, you know, and experience the difference between that and the continuous, you know, wave of your biological reality. And it so quickly flipped the other way. I mean, my mistake was I thought the tools were would intrinsically promote the weird rather than, you know, that they were biased toward that. And it turns out they weren't. They're biased more toward the mean. Right. You know, they're tools of war. What do you expect? But there was that possibility. And on one hand, I don't want to get fooled again. But on the other hand, I believe that I'm much more on the right track looking at Team Human as the place, looking at the pockets like this, just getting, you know, coming to having a regular place, coming to, you know, this club in Soho, ZX on Tuesday nights, and, you know, and just for the purpose of letting something emerge.
It's, I mean, of course, one could also say that every tool is at the mercy of human nature, which is profoundly ugly. And I find invariably, anybody who is preparing to kick me out of an institution is a person who is the most Christian in the room or the most love and light New Ager in the room. And there is such a brutality to human nature, such an inability to just leave the other person alone, to come together maybe for certain collective moments, like an election or like deciding on a good policy, and then retreating, you know, back into privacy. I mean, my ideal world is a world of experimentation with a dental plan. And I mean, it can be done. I don't mean that glibly. There's so much wealth in this society. We just came back from LA, and I love LA. And I walked on Sunset Strip for 3 hours. And it was so educative because there's all this beauty there, and there's all these stores and all these crazy things tucked away and bookstores, and such terrible poverty and desperation and junkies and homeless people. And they're isolated because it's such a sprawling place. And I don't have the slightest solution, but I do know, as I'm sure we all know, that there's sufficient money in our society so that someone could be helped. And, you know, if that someone wants to take his or her monthly check and blow it on heroin, I'm okay with that. As long as there's not violence and mental illness that acts out in ways that's going to hurt somebody, you know, it can be done. It can be done.
But I mean, as the sort of digital economy continues to spin out, I mean, especially as they move into government, we move more towards some kind of a feudalism where there's a few wealthy monarchs in their sort of digital billionaire palaces, and the rest of us move down into this, into a new peasant class.
And you wrote about that in Survival of the Richest, you know, and the book that got you disinvited from Hereticon. We'll try to work on that. But I thought that was a beautiful analysis, and it's a very tough analysis. And, you know, I turned 59 last month, and there are some moments where I'm glad, you know, I'm sort of like, you know, waiting for the phone call. And I don't know how we get our arms around environmental devastation and so forth. I mean, we obviously have to have policies that people agree on, but we're reading from different templates. And you'll have to ask somebody who's more studied in that how that came about.
But what I was going to ask, though, is in prior examples of peasantry, were there occult societies in peasantry, or were they always like up with like working for Queen Elizabeth?
Well, it's interesting. I don't like using the term pagan because in ancient Rome, pagan meant like a backwater villager, somebody to whom the good news of Christianity had not yet arrived. And if you were referred to as a pagan, you were still maybe worshiping Jupiter and you had local household gods. And it took a lot of time for stuff to reach people. So you had people retaining the old ways. I don't know that it was any better. I could understand actually how somebody who was brought up within a polytheistic system of gods who were a lot like human beings, jealous, angry, impulsive, and yet some.
This is Ayo Akinwolere from the Athletic FC podcast. Buying a car should be exciting, not exhausting. And if you're looking for a gleaming SUV to replace your old Banger, or you're taking the plunge and going electric, the good news is you can buy your car completely online on AutoTrader. Really. Just go to autotrader.com and get picky. Search through dealer listings for the make, model, color, and the features that matter to you. Then, just drop in your info and you'll see all the cars that fit your budget. Really. Once you've found the car of your dreams, you can have it delivered to your driveway, or you can pick it up at the dealership. Really. So buy your next car entirely online on AutoTrader. Head to autotrader.com or search the AutoTrader app.
With almost 500,000 customers and over $1 trillion of secure payments, Bill isn't new to intelligent finance. It's the proven way to simplify bill pay and maximize cash flow. Want to learn more? Visit bill.com/proven for a special offer.
Sometimes it would also cut you a break. How being told about the Gospels, obviously nobody could read, but being told about the Gospels, it could have felt very refreshing. So maybe the experiment seemed like, it's just peculiar, you know. I disdain the word pagan because it's a put-down, and yet they were the ones retaining the polytheistic traditions that matter in my life today.
But were there, I understand there were intellectuals at court and writing all their stuff and reading John Dee or doing whatever they were doing, but weren't there also, I mean, I know in Judaism that there were groups that would hang out and argue about Torah. They were the poor ones. Yep. You know, they didn't have to be rich. I mean, were there, like, covens and collectives? And
I think that material from antiquity has come down to us in such fragments. We're really very impoverished, and there's so little that we really have. Even the court historian that Alexander the Great brought around with him, who wrote the Annals of Alexander, they've been lost. We simply don't possess them. There was some anthropologist the other day arguing with me that we have plenty of material from antiquity, and it's like, that is so obviously not true. There are probably longer lists of books that we know existed that we don't have than we have. So it's supposition. But I think some of the people in Alexandria in late antiquity, after the reign of Cleopatra, who were, there was kind of an amalgam of Greek Egyptian wisdom in the city called Hermeticism. And best as we can tell, those people were in very small groups, like maybe groups of 10, groups of 12, best as we can tell. And fragments of that stuff has come down to us. And so it endured, but eventually they couldn't withstand the wave of Christianity and then the wave of Islam. And this stuff was preserved just almost by happy accident.
And then I guess the opposite question is, have you seen it work at scale? I mean, is like Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science, Theosophy, are those, is that, I mean, that's sort of, it feels as close to scale when he writes The Wizard of fucking Oz.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I noticed, speaking of Theosophy, I have correspondence with prisoners from time to time, and I've noticed that a lot of prisoners are reading Theosophy, which probably says something about how egregiously outdated our prison libraries are. You know, you don't meet many people who are like, oh, I can't wait to get to part two of The Secret Doctrine. But, you know, that's what they have. So they go for it. And certainly Mary Baker Eddy did it to scale. She was the founder of the Church of Christian Science, which at a certain point in American history was hugely popular, big religious export. And you'll meet people to this day who will tell you stories of having been physically saved from illness by that church, and other people who have precisely the opposite. And it's very vexing. I tend not to like spirituality to scale. I'm not really a congregational kind of person. I really like a much more private spirituality that we can maybe come together temporarily, like tonight, talk about, and then go back into our privacy.
Well, I mean, the Masons are kind of having to come back.
I really think they are, and I think there's something timely about that. I think it seems to me that Masonry has reemerged at moments where there were very mass chaotic cultural waves that were extremely vexing and troubling to people. And Masonry allows people to kind of retreat back into a place of extreme privacy, even secrecy. And I've noticed, and I base this simply on the number of invitations I get to speak at Masonic lodges, there are lodges which used to be more like drinking clubs, social clubs, charitable clubs, which are turning more esoteric. And that is happening across the country.
But it's like without that retreat, that, let's call it secrecy, I mean, you get fried. You know, we're here, we're living life. It's as if we're on the electric grid of the internet and pop culture. It's just, you can't, it's not sustainable for the organism. You know, yep. You need these, you know, what I'm calling pockets of weird, but retreats or secrets or AA meetings or something that gives you a sense of, you know, I love you, you love me, we're in this together.
Right.
All right, let's go back out.
AA is to scale. I mean, AA has at its roots Jung, William James, some very far out ideas.
In a networked anarchy, though. It's tiny. Yes. It's at scale, but it's the only way you do it. It's a distributed scale.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, it's this archipelago of different groups around the world. And I mean, talk about experiment. There was no place Bill Wilson wouldn't go to try to figure out if there was an answer there to addiction, whether it was LSD or whether it was New Thought or you name it. And so these things, it seems to me they do work to scale. I'm also, and there are some people who are critical of me for this, but it's just the way it is. I really place stock in certain very popular expressions. There are expressions that people would line up, some people, to say are just airset spirituality, bullshit, novelty occultism, like this 1908 little thin book called The Kabbalion, which is basically a novelty work of Hermeticism. And people hate it. It gets people really pissed off. It's crap. It's not the real McCoy. It's bullshit. Yeah. Hermeticism was never widely respected. There was never a good old days for Hermeticism. And so I have discovered things as a kid and as an adult from very popular works, and maybe it's cultural, maybe it's something else. I have sympathy for them.
So fun. I don't know why, because you were talking about Hermeticism. I started to wonder, what do you think happens when we die?
Wow. I think something must, I know something survives. I mean, we know from J.B. Rhine's card tests in the early 1930s that there is an extra physical capacity of intellect. Beyond that, I couldn't fathom a hint. I couldn't fathom a hint. I have no idea how I'll feel on my deathbed. I never used to think about death at all. I didn't care. Now that I'm in my late 50s, I think, well, it's coming. And, you know, if somebody's got a problem, I'm like, good luck. And I think about it very palpably, but I haven't the slightest idea.
Yeah. It's funny. I don't either, but
I'm not scared of it at all. I'm scared of physical decline, which I don't want to experience. And I do think that there must be a new opening for, call it what you will, you know, assisted suicide, euthanasia, whatever, in our society. I really do not wish to endure physical or cognitive decline. Death at this juncture doesn't scare me. I might come back next year and be like, I was wrong. It's horrible, you know, but that's how I feel at this juncture.
I mean, I'm less afraid of decline than I am of actual pain. You know what I mean? If I'm in decline, I'll decline, you know? But I'm still around, you know? I'll be in a wheelchair. I'll talk slower. I'll read slower.
We'll have you out of Mamaronek at a facility, you know?
Whatever. Like,
this is Douglas. And, right, play Mahjong with him.
We can still have the color. We'll have the same talk. It'll just be a little slow down for me. Just
the Sunshine
wait,
Boys.
What were we just... Okay. Yeah, but it's better than nothing, I think.
It's an interesting question. For some people, that's very true.
And I have plausible deniability for everything.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's true. but I suppose people do report these very, very vivid near-death experiences, and I'm not touched by them very often because they use language and concepts that are bound to our present generation. And I noticed that when we were doing the UFO show on Discovery, people would have experiences and they were very sincere and they were very smart together people, engineers, veterans, people with tech experience, and they knew what a drone looked like. And they would speak, though, sometimes in language that was, I don't mean this in a derogatory way, it was very off-the-shelf language just because we use our generational expressions. So in the late 19th century, Teddy Roosevelt wrote this Bigfoot narrative, but he called it a goblin because the word goblin was available to him. I would say Bigfoot, Yeti, Sasquatch. And so the language, I guess we're all having the same conversation, but we draw upon our generational language.
Right. Chupacabra.
Yeah, Chupacabra.
Yeah, that's mine.
Let's bring back Goblin.
Bring back Goblin. There's one last topic I wanted to ask you about before we go. That sort of, as I've come back to New York and back into life, particularly here at CX, I've been exposed to a lot of people who are experimenting with ecstatic dance mm-hmm. and tantra, you know, shamanic sex mm-hmm. as paths to both ecstatic experience and connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you studied kind of have you studied sex magic and ecstatic states and how I mean, for me they always they fall somewhere between hedonism and learning, and it's real easy for them to just be, oh, that was, I came three times, I'm going home. What if there are people here, and we're going to be doing, I'm sure, more educational events that bring people into those kinds of states? How do we maintain a container that promotes the sort of the potential higher learning and magical sensibilities that go along with those activities?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm working on this new book called Practical Magic. And as my leaping off point for the book, I took some writings that Jack Parsons did just before he died. Mm. And Jack made the observation.
People who don't know, Jack Parsons is the guy who did all the rocketry, but was also in these crazy pre-L. Ron Hubbard sex, hermetic dawn, whatever those were, things.
Right. And he was very dedicated to Aleister Crowley. And he had a split with Crowley because Crowley right away identified L. Ron Hubbard as a massive troublemaker. And he was very disappointed in Jack that he let Hubbard into his orbit. But Jack was an idealist, and he was a good man. And Jack, shortly before his death, made the observation that every victory in any idea war since humanity began was based on simplicity, and magic does not have it. And so he asked about the question, could you bring simplicity to magic, strip away some of the liturgy, the ceremony, the, you know, very intense, ornate pageantry or costumery, which was very heavy if you were coming out of, say, the Golden Dawn tradition or even Crowley's tradition at that time. And he died too young to examine that. So I took it as my challenge to try to examine it as much as I'm able. And in Practical Magic, I try to boil magic down to its essentials. I define magic as causative ritual. You do this and something happens. And the conclusion that I came to as I was working on the thing, which I was finally able to realize, is that every truly remarkable figure whose work has reached us, who worked with magic, even people who ostensibly didn't believe in magic, like an Arthur Schopenhauer, they were all working with some form of sex transmutation or sex magic. And it was the sexual impulse that was behind what they were doing. And some have described it in the traditions in a very elliptical way, some moderns in a much plainer way, that sexuality is described as the urge of life seeking expression, the urge of life seeking expression. And so very often we are raised to see that expression as procreation or physical pleasure. But if it's expression that you're after, couldn't it be applied to anything, athletics or some work of creative expression, or for that matter, getting along with somebody you can't stand, but you have to get along with them in a lifeboat or something? So it's harnessing that sexual urge. I remember, there's a very brilliant woman who I knew once upon a time, and she was friends with some men, and she grew to disdain them because she said of these men, their whole life is about coming. Their entire existence is centered around coming. And I thought she made a very, very good observation, and I sympathized with it. But as much as I respect and like her, I moved away from it later because I thought, it's not exactly that. That might be the overt act, but they're seeking expression, they're seeking creativity, and sometimes we get directed into very narrow channels for that, whereas it can be broader. Yes, it can be pleasure. Yes, it can be procreation, but it can also be the application of the sexual urge, the creative urge, the urge to be generative, can be channeled toward anything. So that's the basis of the book. That's the simplicity, I hope, that speaks to what Jack was after.
right? So if you come, if you do a night of ecstatic trance dance, do you, does it require a set and setting of some kind, a setting of intention in order for it to have its effect?
I do think there should be a setting of intention. I mean, it doesn't require anything formal. And the thing I love about it is it's totally private. You don't have to tell anybody you're doing it. You don't have to tell your shrink or your boyfriend, your girlfriend, or your, you know, neighbor Mike or whatever.
Or the other dancers in the room.
Or the other dancers. It's up to you. But if you reach climax in whatever way and you set an intention, I would say I feel as close to certain as I can be that there is something causative about that. Something will happen.
Oh, wait. I tried a little sigil magic lately, right? Just a fucking drop. And, oh, it happened. It all happened so fast, yeah, and so strong that I had to do another sigil just to adjust.
Right.
The first sigil. You're like,
the golem is knocking down my door.
I know. Shit. It's like, he's okay, going away. Okay. I didn't mean that. I meant this.
Let me add one thing to that, if I may. When you do a magical operation, sometimes something can happen very clearly and very quickly. But I believe it's also important to be very watchful, because sometimes the thing that you're looking for, we have such a mind's eye prejudice about how it should arrive and what it should look like. It could reach you in a way maybe that's very mundane, so much so that you're apt to say, who cares? Or it could reach you in a way that's very exotic and weird and that just doesn't appeal to you. So there's all these ancient myths and parables about like a mysterious stranger wandering the earth in search of hospitality, and everyone turns the person away. And then once in a while, some good, generous soul will say, yeah, you know, come on in my house. I'll give you water, bread. And they're rewarded and showered with riches. It turns out the mysterious stranger was an angel or a demon or royalty disguised. Magic can be like that. So watch very carefully for the arrival, because it could reach you through channels that are very unexpected, you know, as well as expected and shocking. But sometimes you'd be like, oh, shit, nothing happened. Just watch. Watch very, very carefully.
I do. And I think we have arrived. my friends from the UK know a different meaning of that word, too. Especially
arrived.
Arrived.
What,
yeah,
is it vulgar?
To
the
come.
UK?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He has arrived.
How do you like that?
But thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Mitch Horowitz. Thanks for being on
Thank
Team
you.
Human.
Pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone at CX, especially our on-site engineer, Oz, program curator, Jessica Carson, CX founder and reality tamer, William Atundi, and all the members of this collective and Team Human who made this possible through your support. If you want to join us at our monthly live shows at CX, all you have to do is join CX or become a supporting member of Team Human at Patreon or teamhuman.fm. Throughout our conversation, you've been listening to the soundscapes of the wonderful Stephen Brent, whose music is available at stephenbrent.bedcamp.com. Our opening theme is a gift from Fugazi, and our closing theme, Under Me Now, is by Mike Watt on bass. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelaine and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Thank you so
Thanks.
Much. Thank you, my man. That was
beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
Over 90 of the top 100 U.S. accounting firms trust Bill to simplify and secure bill pay. That's proven financial infrastructure built on over $1 trillion of secure payments. Visit bill.com/proven for a special offer.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Christian Bale was preparing for his role in American Psycho, dressing the part, hitting the gym for the first time in his life, even getting his teeth redone. There was just one problem. He didn't actually have the part. Leonardo DiCaprio did. Listen to our podcast, What Went Wrong, every week as we unearth the chaos behind Hollywood's biggest movie flops and most shocking successes. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.